Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded August 28th and September 4th, 2024. Well, the United States Monday seized Venezuela's Air Force One, the country's presidential jet, as it awaited maintenance in the Dominican Republic. The Americans insist their appropriation legitimate because the jet's purchase violated sanctions placed on Venezuela and its president, Nicolas Maduro. It's not the first time the U.S. has intercepted vessels and cargo and people under this precept. Naturally, the Venezuelan government is outraged, charges the move was theft, and says America is nothing less than a pirate state. Well, welcome to the waning days of empire. James Joe Bissett is a former Canadian ambassador whose tenure in Yugoslavia coincided with that country's 1991 dissolution. At century's end, he was one of the few government insiders to oppose NATO's 78-day bombardment of Serbia, all in the name of humanitarian intervention. Joe Bissett in the first half. And August is not the time to be in Paris. The weather tends to mugginess, and Parisians harden their attitude towards the seasonal throng of tourists run now too long. This year is the same as all years, only more so. The Olympics disruption has worn, and all are eager for the coolness of the fall and return to normalcy. But even as the last of the summer visitors depart, things will not be normal in Paris or in France. Diana Johnstone is an author and journalist. Her book titles include From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon, Nuclear War Planning, Circle in the Darkness, Memoirs of a World Watcher, and Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusion. Her articles can be found at consortiumnews.com, where her recent piece, D-Day 2024, appears. Diana Johnstone, and if not burning, Paris is smoldering in the second half. But first, Joe Bissett and Whither the Diplomat's Art in World Affairs Today. Welcome back to the show, Joe.
What about it?
Well, it's great to speak with you again way out there in Ottawa. Hey, Joe, now tell me, first of all, I'm interested to know, what role do sanctions play in the game of international diplomacy, both historically and as we're seeing them used today in Canada and especially the United States?
Some sanctions in the past certainly have worked. I think one of the classic examples is when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia, I think in 1935. Actually, Canada made a motion at the League of Nations that sanctions should be applied to Mussolini's Italy, oil, iron, and steel. And the committee that he was on accepted that. And if that had maintained as a sanction, it would have stopped Mussolini within about 2 weeks. They would not have the oil to use their armor against the Ethiopian spearmen. Unfortunately, the motion that was made by our representative in Geneva at the time was overruled by the government back in Ottawa. And quite shamefully, he had to get up and say that his motion really didn't exist. And therefore, sanctions against Italy were not applied. And of course, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia and basically took it over after terrible casualties from the bombing of villages in Ethiopia and so on. But that's an example of a sanction that could have worked but didn't. Canada's kind of gone wild with sanctions. I mean, we're sanctioning deputy chiefs of police somewhere in Iran that's probably never heard of us. We're sanctioning all sorts of Russians, left and right, businessmen, politicians, down to the deputy minister level. I mean, it's a farce, but it makes Canada look, you know, that, oh, we're really tough in there, and we're sanctioning, issuing all these sanctions. The sanctions against Russia recently, the most, the biggest sanctions and the more serious ones, are simply not working, because you have to get almost a total number of nations to join the sanctions. And Russia still has many, many strong friends and people who are not particularly interested in losing their oil and other products that they have for sale. So it's a mixed bag. I don't have much faith in it, quite frankly.
Well, do you think, Joe, that the sanctions are incorporated in Canada's diplomatic toolbox Are they being used at the direction more of the United States, or is this a made in Canada policy or just copycatting?
Well, I think it's one of a little bit of both of that. It makes us look good that we're really doing something, you know, to hold back Putin in the war in Ukraine. Makes us look good. It makes us fall in line with the United States policy, even though we don't meet our NATO objectives. It's a symbolic gesture that, in my view, is basically meaningless.
Well, as well as stopping wars, I think sanctions, too, can start them. They were blamed back in the era that you cited with Mussolini for the sanctions against the Japanese Empire have been depicted in certain historical takes as being a provocation of the Japanese to provoke them into attacking Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
Do you follow that?
Yes, I do. I think you're absolutely right. Certainly, when the U.S. applied the oil and gasoline sanctions on Japan, the Japanese were faced with, they had to do something about it, or they wouldn't be able to continue to exist and carry out with their empire. So it was a provocation that pulled the trigger and got the Japanese to thinking if they could knock out that U.S. fleet, Pacific Fleet, they would have enough time to get organized and take over good parts of Southeast Asia that would supply them with the raw material that they needed. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It's a good example of sanctions starting basically almost a world war, although the war had already started, bringing the Japanese into it.
Well, I mention it in regards to Venezuela. As I said in the introduction, that just on Monday, the United States seized the presidential plane. The sanctions against that country, the list is too long to go into, and it's been on for such a long time as well, going back to Maduro's predecessor, yeah. Hugo Chavez.
Yeah. Well, I don't like it, quite frankly, for the reasons you've given. It's provocative, and in many cases, it doesn't work. So it's a nuisance, but it makes the sancting or the people who are doing the sancting look a little better politically. But, Venezuela is a good example. How long have they had sanctions there and nothing has changed? Well, there's been an attempted change, but it goes on and on. The local people in Venezuela are the ones who suffer from that, not the government. Sanctions only hurts the population, doesn't really bother the government and their military ambitions. That's my view.
And that much has been admitted. And I wonder how that jives with the concept of collective punishment, because it seems to me that that is exactly what it is, the deprivation of the population for the crimes or perceived crimes of the elite or the leadership. And these can be measured in real deaths. The healthcare sector, for example, in Venezuela has suffered tremendously, and they cite tens of thousands of deaths, as was the case in Iraq during Saddam Hussein's tenure there.
It always is. That's how it works, really. The population suffers, and the dictators or the government, whatever they may be, continue on. It strengthens them in some ways because the population are basically nationalist and are proud of their country. And if the government, even if it is a dictatorship, they have a tendency to try and support it when foreigners come in and start trying to tell them how to run their government.
Well, John, I want to pick your brain. I mean, you were in the diplomatic corps. You made a career out of it. When you look at the kind of diplomacy or what passes for diplomacy that we see today for example, Venezuela, but also in Ukraine and in the Middle East as well, and China especially, too. I read a recent piece from a Chinese think tank that they can't believe what passes for diplomacy in the United States right now, that the attitude they compare, I'll paraphrase, to a churlish child. What's your view of current diplomacy as practiced by the superpower and its acolytes like Canada?
Well, I'm not very happy about it. And as you know, I had my opportunity to see how the United States, when the wall came down and we all thought the Cold War was over, that we could have peace and quiet in the world and tackle some of our major problems that, you know, may touch us, from climate and geography and lack of food in many of the countries. Instead of that, the Americans saw that as a opportunity, as they themselves expressed it, as an opportunity to be the world's strongest man and to dominate the rest of the world with a so-called spectrum dominance, full specter dominance. They gave it a name. And then they went on from that to actually naming the whole thing, calling, you know, the introduction of a new American century. Now we can dominate the world. We increase defense spending, and we'll be able to fight decisively, and this is the way they put it, and to win multiple simultaneously major theater wars. That was the big turning point, I think, for me and for many others. It was a misguided interpretation and probably the most serious foreign policy, certainly of the beginning of our centuries, 20th, 21. And it's an absolute disgrace in a way. Misguided, I think, perhaps, and it continues today. You know, I mean, both Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur, two of their most famous generals, when they were leaving, MacArthur, I can almost remember what he said, that, you know, and this was back in 1950, 51, maybe 52, said, you know, that the United States is geared now to an arms economy, which was bred in a kind of artificially induced psychosis of war hysteria and nurture upon an incessant propaganda of fear. And that continues today. I mean, if you watch American television, you see that they look upon the Russians as enemies, the Chinese as enemies. They create an atmosphere of fear. We're all worried now that we thought when the Cold War came down, we could forget about the nuclear war. Now we're so close to it that we've never been this close before, and it doesn't stop. The United States, in my view, is an empire that is clearly in decline, and that makes it extremely dangerous. I don't have to tell you, but, you know, when you get at the strongest nation in the world, going to have a president, on the one hand, a narcissist and someone who doesn't always tell the truth, and on the other hand, a woman who basically, as we already know because of her record, is not very smart. And one of those is going to be in charge of the most serious nation in the world, engaged now in a war going on in Ukraine, which they started, and trouble elsewhere. At the same time, losing a lot of former friends. There's major changes taking place in the world, and new powers are coming to full force. Brazil, India, these countries may not be as so-called democratic as the United States, but they should not be enemies. And none of these should be enemies. I mean, the Russian people don't want war. They lost 27 million people in the Second World War. Russia knows all about war and killing. And part of the problem with North America, we've never been bombed. We've never had bombs hailing down on us. You know, if you watch most of American TV now, they've lost interest really in Ukraine. And they're more interested in, you know, whether the defensive back, Yelky or whatever his name is, going to play football now that he's become a celebrity. It's scary stuff.
Bread and circuses. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with James Joe Bizet. Joe is a former Canadian ambassador. His tenure in Yugoslavia, or the nation of former Republic of Yugoslavia, coincided with that country's 1991 dissolution. He opposed almost entirely alone inside of government, inside of this government, at least the Canadian government, NATO's 78-day bombardment of Serbia back in the day in the name of the then newly coined humanitarian intervention doctrine. Well, Joe, I'm really fascinated to hear what you said about Joe MacArthur, because I was aware, I think as most people are, of Eisenhower.
Douglas MacArthur.
Douglas MacArthur. I mean, we're aware of Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex that was the coin to coin the term at the time. Yeah. I didn't know that about Douglas MacArthur. He's always been presented in history, as far as I can tell, as an uber hawk.
He wasn't a dumb one.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating because, you know, I remember that when you talk about the ending of the Cold War, I grew up in that period where, you know, going to school, it was the Damoclean sword of nuclear annihilation was over us all the time. And when the wall came down and when the Soviet Union dissolved, there was the so-called peace dividend. And that was the idea that all this money that had been devoted to military and to the arms race and to nuclear annihilation and so forth could now be redirected into programs of social uplift, as Martin Luther King might say. And yet this was the moment when George Bush the first, and then following him, the neocons hijacked policy. And it wasn't just the neocons too, though. We've got to give Clinton his due.
He turned the NATO peace treaty upside down. NATO's Article 1 of the North Atlantic Treaty, remember it's a treaty, said that NATO would never use or threaten to use force in the resolution of international disputes and would always act in accordance with the United Nations Charter. In 1999, on NATO's 50th birthday, Clinton called a birthday party in Washington and announced at that time that from now on, we're bombing, because this was in the middle of the bombing of Serbia, which is a violation of the UN Charter and a violation of the North Atlantic Treaty. But Clinton pulled it off by saying we're changing NATO. We're going to now intervene militarily wherever and whenever we decide to do so. Oh, yes, and one other thing. Although one of the Bushes promised Gorbachev that if we let East Germany come into NATO with Western Germany, NATO would never move 1 kilometer eastward. Now, Clinton didn't mention that, but the fact of the matter is he also announced at the birthday party, while they were bombing Yugoslavia, or Serbia, I should say, he did announce that, oh, by the way, boys, we're going to have Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, and I think it was one more, Romania perhaps, into NATO. Outrageously. Putin was alarmed about that, as rightly he might have been, since he was already surrounded by former historical enemies of Russia in the Balkan states. He said, I'm going to remember this, you know, you've broken a promise, and it scares us in Russia. We've had a few invasions of our own. We don't want another one. In the meantime, after those three or four joined NATO, NATO put missile bases in Poland and in the Czech Republic. When Putin wondered what were they aimed against, they said Iran. And he kind of chuckled and said, well, it looks to me they could get to Moscow in about 3 minutes. So, I mean, it's a bit of a mess that we've got on our hands, but I don't know how we're going to come out of it.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Joe.
Sorry to be so pessimistic.
Well, I think we're in pessimistic times largely, and otherwise I wouldn't be doing this program at all. But we're fast running out of time, Joe. But before we go, I mentioned China and the lack of diplomacy. This article by Professor Shen Yi that I read in at a site called the China Academy, fascinating. He's very dismissive, reluctantly so at first, and in the most diplomatic way. He's very polite, and he says he doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I'm paraphrasing here, but he says that the Americans are absolutely delusional when it comes to diplomacy. They're going to he compares it to turning your cheek to be slapped twice, but that not being enough, the Americans want you to praise them for slapping you the second time, is how he characterizes the kind of diplomacy coming from Sullivan, who just recently visited China, somebody that doesn't have really diplomatic credentials beyond being an assistant, a defense advisor. What does this, if you're going to be taught, if you're in the diplomatic corps, independent of America, in as a Canadian, as impossible as that is to imagine, what would your approach be to trying to start some kind of fence mending with the Chinese government that we have insulted repeatedly here in Canada in these last years?
Yes. Well, at one time we were close friends with them, as you know. They admired our first Trudeau prime minister. We had, I forget his name now, the doctor who went off to China.
Bethune, Norman Bethune.
Yes. And we certainly switched around completely on that. No, I see no reason. I mean, what puzzles me is why would the Chinese get in the least bit worried about the American fleet in the South China Sea?
Yeah,
but that's what's happening.
The nerve they have of putting their name on America's sea.
Well, exactly. No, it's really scary stuff, you know, and I don't see the leadership. I wrote a long article on the Ukraine thing. I called it Sleepwalking Again, Sarajevo 1914, Ukraine 2022. There's a book written by an English author, a historian, a couple of years ago called The Sleepwalkers, in which he carefully analyzes all the reasons for the 1914 First World War, which killed some 50 million people, and concluded it was simply because the leaders of the day were out of touch with what was really going on and were sleepwalking into war.
Well, I'm currently reading Carl Jung's Red Book, and in the preface, he says somebody asks him in 1913, asks him, well, what his vision of the future, because that was a very turbulent period in history, and especially in Europe at that moment. And he says, well, I don't know, but all I see are rivers of blood.
Yeah, well, that's
Do you think that we're at a similar point now? Is there an analogy here to the sleepwalking, somnambulism?
No, I think we're getting closer and closer to catastrophic. If the Ukraine war doesn't stop soon, in some sort of compromise reach, and continues to go on, I mean, if you look at the front page of the National Post today, with a good old friend of mine, Derek Burney, is saying we must not give up Ukraine, and we must not give up Israel. Even if that means a nuclear war, I gather. But, the other thing people don't realize, in the planning guide of the new American century, one of the first things they did was unilaterally withdraw the nuclear ballistic missile treaty without any warning to Russia. People don't remember that, but the Russians remember it. Without warning, the U.S. just totally withdrew. And then they set up bases in Poland and so on. They'd love to have bases in Georgia. They keep saying Russia invaded Georgia. Russia didn't invade Georgia. The United States armed Georgia to the teeth and then basically told them to go and take the two parts of Georgia that refused to go with Georgia and remained with Russia. And they attacked South Ossetia. The Georgians attacked South Ossetia. Well, the Russian security know more about what was going on there than the Georgians did. And, of course, counterattack drove them, the Georgians back, blew up a couple of their military bases on the border and quickly withdrew. Is that an invasion of Georgia? The first thing Bush did after the Georgians retreated was give Georgia an unlimited amount of money to completely rebuild their military. That had got knocked about by the Russians. So it's scary stuff, and I don't see the leadership in the United States. I don't see the major media playing properly here. You know, it's once again, it's as it was in the First World War, the media cheering on, going, let's go, boys, our boys will go and beat these Germans, so on. Yeah, scary stuff.
Well, yeah, and it's Douglas MacArthur's vision come to reality. We're going to get cut off any second from the Zoom thing I've got. But before I go, Joe, the last time we talked, November 15th, you said to me that it's a war, not a genocide in Gaza, because Hamas declared war. So we're in day 300, and today is day 333 of that ongoing war. I contend this is a genocide, a 21st century Holocaust going on, a determined, designed, and directed erasure of an entire people. Do you still contend that that's not the case?
In 1938, the British had a cabinet meeting. The former prime minister, who was a member of the cabinet, was no longer prime minister. They were wondering what's going to happen in England if there is a war and the Germans start bombing us, because we know it's not going to be with Zeppelins, it's going to be with heavy bombers and with hundreds of them. And somebody posed on that, and the old prime minister said, just a minute now. He said, one thing you got to learn, you can't stop the bombing, it will go on. If there is a war, the country that wins the war will be the country that has killed the most women and children due to bombing. And that kind of sobered everybody. But the fact is, the bombing on Germany cost over 600,000 civilian casualties. One night in Hamburg, 40,000 civilians were killed by British bombing. So when a war starts and you're getting into cruise missiles and bombing, it's going to be killing women and children. And who's going to last longest? It's got to stop. Somehow we got to get on to the business of talking these things over and looking at each other as friends and dealing with them and trading with them and exchanging them. But we can't do that, I'm afraid, with Trump and with, what's her name, Kamala. We'll see.
Kamala Harris. Yeah, they're all just tools, it seems to me. And I can't see the equivalency between the war between the Nazi regime and Britain. I don't see the equivalency here when, you know, Hamas doesn't have an army. They're more like a French resistance. I mean, it had the Germans bombed France flat entirely. And systematically scorched-earthed the whole country in a southerly manner to have the French remnants then go into Spain or into the sea. It didn't matter which, with the idea that after the war there would be Germans in France now and it would be part of Greater Germany. That's what the equivalency I see right now. And the amount of bombs that have been dropped into that tiny space of Gaza, 20 miles by 6 or 7 miles wide or something like this, equivalent to several nuclear bombs in explosive capability and everything else. I just don't see this as an equivalency. This is a systematic erasure of a people. And what's going on in the West Bank underlines that.
Yeah, but this has been going on since what?
1948.
Yeah, 1948. And it's not going to stop, I'm afraid.
Well, and that is where our connection to Zoom stopped. I want to thank Joe Bissett for coming on. And I want to remind everyone to stick around. I'm going to be joined by Diana Johnstone from Paris in the second half. We're going to talk about the situation there and that country's eroding democracy and Europe as a whole. Stick around for that.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, August is not the time to be in Paris. The weather tends to mugginess, and Parisians harden their attitude towards the seasonal throng of tourists. Run now too long. This year is the same as all years, only more so. The Olympics disruption has worn, and all are eager for the coolness of the fall and return to normalcy. But even as the last of the summer visitors departs, things will still not be normal in Paris, nor in France.